Nevertheless, the influence of Mach's principle and Newton's laws concerning such correlates as the angular momentum of the Earth, Sun, and galaxy also figured into his cosmological paradigm. The Buddhist expresses it one way, the Christian in another, but both say the same. We are all one. Science, too, recognizes this connectedness of separate individuals, though not quite in the same sense that it admits that the suns, planets, and moons of a constellation are one body, and there can be no doubt that it will be experimentally confirmed in times to come. Having studied will psychology, occult psychological principles, as a youth, Tesla was a firm believer in self-determination and the incredible power of the will. Somehow, however, he reconciled this internal procedure, which the philosopher George Gurdjieff links to a direct expression of the soul, to his external behavioristic paradigm. For Tesla, the spark of life is not only biological, but also present in the structure of matter. Even matter called inorganic, believed to be dead, responds to irritants and gives unmistakable evidence of a living principle within. Such things as metals respond to stimuli, e.g. magnets. Tesla refuses to separate the motive forces involved in electromagnetic effects from reactions of living matter. This, in essence, was Bulwer-Lytton's vril power. The energy that runs the universe directs life. Thus, everything that exists, organic or inorganic, animated or inert, is susceptible to stimulus from the outside. There is no gap between, no break in continuity, no special and distinguishing vital agent. The momentous question of Spencer, what is it that causes inorganic matter to run into organic forms, has been answered. It is the sun's heat and light. Wherever they are, there is life. As Tesla himself was a self-propelled automaton entirely under the control of external influences, he could use the model of himself to build his teleautomaton. What we call memory, Tesla further stated, is but increased responsiveness to repeated stimuli. Creative thinking and also dreaming will be derived from secondary reverberations of these initial external stimuli. Long ago, I conceived the idea of constructing an automaton which would mechanically represent me, and which would respond as I do myself, but of course in a much more primitive manner, to external influences. Such an automaton evidently had to have motive power, organs for locomotion, directive organs, and one or more sensitive organs so adapted as to be excited by external stimuli. Whether the automaton be of flesh and bone or of wood and steel, it mattered little, provided it could provide all the duties required of it like an intelligent being. To Tesla, his remote-controlled boat was not simply a machine. It was a new technological creation, endowed with the ability to think. In Tesla's view, it was also, in a sense, the first non-biological life form on the planet. As a prototype, this first new life form was embodied, in Tesla's words, with a borrowed mind, his own. It will be able to follow a course laid out, or obey commands given far in advance. It will be capable of distinguishing between what it ought and what it ought not to do, and of recording impressions which will definitely affect its subsequent actions. Very few individuals could comprehend the magnitude of the creation in 1898, and so they lashed out at Tesla instead. In November 1898, the Examiner-in-Chief of Patents came to witness a demonstration of Tesla's teleautomaton before granting a patent, so unbelievable was the claim. I remember that when later I called on an official in Washington with a view of offering the invention to the government, Tesla wrote, he burst out in laughter. Nobody thought then that there was the faintest prospect of perfecting such a device. 24. Waldorf Astoria, 1898. November the 29th, 1897. My dear Luca, I have concluded that so important a literary event as the appearance of your splendid book of poems should be firstly commemorated by a dinner at the Waldorf, as Mrs. Philipoff suggested in her peculiarly delicate way. As this does not seem possible because of your immense popularity, I would like you to name another evening very soon, however, for my money may run out. Yours sincerely, N. Tesla. The Waldorf Astoria was the tallest hotel in the world, a centre for banquets, concerts and conventions in the city, and the permanent or temporary residence of the wealthiest and most eminent citizens of the day. Residing there became a goal to which Tesla aspired. It would be one he would achieve before the end of the year, and one he would maintain for the next 2 decades. Built in 2 parts, the original Waldorf was completed by William Waldorf Astor in 1893, the Astoria by his cousin John Jacob Astor in late 1897. At first, Jack was reluctant to tear down his mother's home to erect a hotel, but after the Waldorf grossed $4.5 million in its first year, he changed his mind. Its opening marked the beginning of a new concept in living, extolling the essence of exclusiveness, cordiality, pomposity, and elegant grandiosity to the masses. The manager, George C. Bolt, was a Prussian immigrant from the island of Rügen, situated near Denmark in the Baltic Sea. Mild-mannered, dignified, and unassuming, Bolt resembled a typical German professor with his close-cropped beard, which he kept fastidiously trimmed, and his pince-nez glasses on a black silk cord. Described also as a martinet and a man of mercurial moods, Bolt was a socialite, in certain ways, of the most superficial kind. "I would rather see Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish enjoying a cup of tea in an all but empty palm room," Bolt declared, "than a dozen lesser-known guests there feasting." The manager also adored mechanical contrivances, sprinkling the hotel with such modern conveniences as pneumatic tubes, electric bulb, carriage calls, flashing control panels on the elevators, and his network of hushed but authoritative buzzers. A few years later, the Waldorf would be the first hotel with a radio tower. No doubt Tesla himself, an elitist, was attractive to Bolt. With his position of inventor extraordinaire well established, it is likely that the inventor was accepted in a distinct class above the manager. Once he moved in, Tesla may even have avoided paying rent in lieu of his connection with Astor, or he may have negotiated a favorable deal. With over 900 on staff, the acclaimed Oscar of the Waldorf as chef, and Bolt's capable wife overseeing the decor, there was no finer establishment. A regal fragrance wafted from every corner of the hotel, with exquisite porcelain, exotic flowers, and expensive furniture decorating the halls, dining rooms, and suites. This was the alley where the peacocks came to strut. At over 6'2", and dressed in suede high tops, tails, cane, top hat, and ever-present white gloves, Nikola Tesla was one of the proudest and most renowned. The Spanish-American War dragged on through most of 1898 as Tesla continued to try to exploit his teleautomaton for use as a naval weapon. He had offered his wireless transmitters to aid in the organizing of ship and troop movements, but was turned down by the Secretary of the Navy for fear, as Tesla reported a year later, "that I might cause a calamity, as sparks are apt to fly anywhere in the neighborhood of such apparatus when it is at work." Tesla tried to guarantee that he had overcome these defects and limitations, but it was to no avail. Public demonstrations and photographs of lightning bolts spewing from his ingenuity worked to hinder any assurances he might give. Instead, during the conflict, the Navy utilized hot air balloons connected to ships by telegraph lines instead. Being up in one would make a man's hair turn white, since the balloon was an easy target, but soldiers had to obey orders, and that was all there was to it. Tesla contacted shipbuilder Mr. Nixon, designer of the Oregon, the Villard ocean liner he had fixed while working for Tom Edison in 1884, and also submarine builder John P. Holland. 2 years later, Holland would sell the Navy its first submersible. It would weigh a commanding 74 tons, and become a quintessential fighting machine. But in 1898, he was still having difficulty negotiating a deal. The Navy Department was obliged to decline Holland's offer to go into Santiago Harbor and destroy the Spanish warships, as it smacked of privateering and was in violation of international law. And Tesla also invited military personnel to his laboratory, particularly U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Francis J. Higginson, chairman of the Lighthouse Board, to discuss the use of his wireless transmitters. But dealing with the government was anything but easy. During this period, in June 1898, Richmond Pearson Hobson rocketed to stardom, capturing the hearts of America through his heroic efforts in the war. A few months later, Hobson would become the key attraction of the Tesla-Johnson social net, and a decade after that, his fame so well established, he would become a presidential candidate. On June the 4th, the New York Times reported that a bold American fighting frigate, the Merrimack, had made a dash into Santiago Harbor under a lively cannonade of fire in attempts to attack the waiting Spanish Armada. The ship was sunk, and an officer, an engineer, and six seamen were taken prisoners. The Times concluded, "Everybody is astounded at the audacity of the American vessel." The following day, it was revealed that enemy fire had not sunk the ship at all. Rather, it had been deliberately scuttled by Lieutenant Hobson for the purpose of locking in the harbor the entire Spanish fleet. This splendid stroke effectively removed the feared Admiral Cervera from the war. In a day, in an hour, the potent, all-pervading force of electricity flashed his fame over the round world. As Hobson was imprisoned in the dungeon of Morro Castle, he continued to make headlines as the world waited for the war to end and his hoped-for release. As ever, Catherine continued to spread her Irish charms, inviting the Serbian mystic to dinner so that she could be hypnotized by his presence. The very day of the sinking of the Merrimack, the inventor received the following provocative missive. June the 6th, 1898. Dear Mr. Tesla, I want very much to see you tomorrow evening, and will be really disappointed if you do not think my request worthy of your consideration. Robert is giving himself a birthday party, and he's going to have some of your Serbian songs sung. You must save this evening for us. After this date, I am going away to Washington for a visit, so if anybody cares to see Mrs. Filipov. When you come tomorrow evening, we'll talk about the hand which is before me now, but which is doomed to seclusion. I cannot stand it. It is too strong, too virile. When I enter the room without thinking, it makes me start. It is the only thing in it. But it is not satisfactory, for it does not give the proper idea of your hand, which is large and free. Like yourself, this seems sticky, short. I know what causes this. It is the shadows. You must try again and make your hand be as large and grand as it is. Faithfully yours, Catherine Johnson. In January, Tesla had published a full-page photograph of his hand for Electrical Review in his attempts to dramatically display the improvements he had made in the efficiency of his vacuum lamps. Every line on the palm was visible, so effective was the illuminant, although, as Catherine points out, the shape is marred by an underlying shadow. The famous palmist Cairo was the rage of the day, having published analyses of the hands of such celebrities as Tom Edison, Sarah Bernhardt, and theosophist Annie Besant. Mark Twain commented, "Cairo has exposed my character to me with humiliating accuracy. I ought not to confess this accuracy. Still, I am moved to do it." It seemed likely that Tesla's clever vanity had come upon a way to exploit his fluorescent tubes, and at the same time reveal in a veiled way the magnanimity of his being by exposing his hand to the world. Referring to a professional palmist, Tesla's hand supposedly reveals a flirtatious streak and hypersensitivity seen in the girdle of Venus. From the headline, "Incessant Worries Stemming from the Past," a close association with his mother because it is tied to the heart line, an irrational streak and blind spot in his thinking, due to chaining, an undulating course and foreshortening of the line. And all of this is counterbalanced by a remarkable fate line, which, rising like a firm oak tree, reveals stability, vision, creative aspiration, stubbornness, and an ability to withstand great stress and turmoil. The fate line is the strongest line in the hand. During these months, playful banter peaked between the inventor and the elusive Madame Filipov. It seems she tried to get Tesla married. In February, Catherine wrote, "Another charming lady is to be here who does not believe that you are my friend, that I even know you. I wish to convince her that you are on my list, and you shall sit beside her. Come and shed the radiance of your happy countenance upon us all, especially the Johnsons." In March, she demands Tesla join them for lunch, "to bring solace to your friends. and a few days later invites him over again. A very charming girl is to be here who wants very much to meet Mr. Tesla. A real one, I assure you. Tesla decides to have everyone for dinner first and writes, I shall send my private equipage to dine at the Waldorf, and I am getting up the appetite for the occasion. Tesla's celibacy has always been a question mark. It seems probable that he and Catherine had engaged in a sticky liaison a few years earlier, but at this stage, due in part to Catherine's arrangements, Tesla had become active with other women, and Catherine had enjoyed his pleasures vicariously. Three ladies who interested him were Mrs. Winslow, Miss Amartya Kushner, and Miss Marguerite Merrington. The first, alas, was married. To the second, Tesla wanted to display his inventions at his laboratory. There is another reason why she should come, but that is difficult to say. Well, I do not want to say anything disparaging of a lady. For yet another Johnson blowout, Tesla wrote concerning the third lady, I'd sooner be glad to rely on your choice and only remember to suggest Miss Merrington, if she would come. I know I would be her victim before dinner, but after that I think I could hold my own, for she does not drink claret. And a few months later, March 9th, 1899. My dear Mrs. Johnson, I shall be glad to have any of your friends come, but we must have one lady for each gentleman, else you must dine without me. Agnes must come by all means, and wouldn't you invite Miss Merrington? She is such a wonderfully clever woman. I would say wise, had she but married. Really, I would like to have her with us. Sincerely, Nicholas I of Houston Street. Born in England, Marguerite Merrington was raised in a convent in Buffalo before she studied the piano and became a teacher at her alma mater, Normal College. Resigning to move to New York City to follow her passion of dramatic author, Miss Merrington first made headlines in 1891 with her well-received romantic play, Letter Blair. This success was followed 2 years later when she won a $500 prize from the National Conservatory of Music for her libretto Daphne, which was reviewed by, among others, Antonin Dvorak. Tall, graceful, and charming, the regal Miss Merrington was a frequent dinner guest at the Johnson home. An integral part of the Gramercy Park set, Miss Merrington accompanied the young Owen Johnson to Mark Twain's birthday party in 1905 and maintained her creative spark throughout her life, writing a book on General Custer and his wife in 1950, the year before she died, unmarried, at the age of 91. In August 1898, John Jacob Astor returned from the battlegrounds, but it was not until December that Tesla met with Astor at his home. While Jack was considered by many to be cold-hearted, humorless, weak-minded, and almost completely absent of personality, his wife, Ava, was seen as the most beautiful woman in America. Tesla was particularly taken by Lady Astor's loveliness, and it seems that she was enthralled by the inventor's experiments. The three dined together on occasion at Delmonico's, or the Waldorf, and when Tesla arrived at the Astors' residence, he often brought along a bouquet of flowers. But although Ava sparkled at every lighted candle, and Jack followed her about like a bedraggled and slightly bad-tempered spaniel, all was not well with the marriage. Where Astor was able to leave his exquisite wife for months on end, touring the high seas for adventure and the noble cause, she retreated by entertaining a zealous interest in bridge. Thus, even though Ava was on his side, the inventor was uncertain of his standing. "My dear Astor," Tesla began, "I would like to explain why I could not go down to Cuba with you."
"I understand," Astor replied. "During the gunfire, perhaps, that is when it dawned on me. I realized that your life was too precious to risk on such a trip. I see, however, from recent reports that you have been attacked after all, but it has been by reporters instead."
"I am glad," Tesla quipped, "that I am living in a place in which, though they can roast me in the papers, they cannot burn me at the stake."
Tesla thereupon called a meeting with Astor and two of his cronies, Mr. Clarence McKay and Mr. Darius Ogden Mills, so that he could display his continuing progress with his oscillators and fluorescent lights, as well as show them patent applications, articles which had appeared in the technical journals, and reports on tests performed by the Royal Society in London
and the Roentgen Society in Germany. Let me read you the following dispatch from Sir William Crookes, Tesla said. Congratulations, the performance of your machine is marvellous. And Tesla presented another report which hailed his oscillator as one of the most significant of the age. You will see how many enterprises can be built up on that novel principle, Colonel. It is for a reason that I am often and violently attacked, because my inventions threaten a number of established industries. My teleautomaton, for instance, opens up a new art which will sooner or later render large guns entirely useless and will make impossible the building of large battleships, and will, as I have stated in my patent, long before the Tsar's manifesto, compel the nations to come to an understanding for the maintenance of peace.
You are taking too many leaps for me, Astor said, causing the others to reconsider as well. Let us stick to the oscillators and cold lights. Let me see some success in the marketplace with these two enterprises before you go off saving the world with an invention of an entirely different order, and then I will commit more than my good wishes. Stop in again when you have a sound proposal, or call me on the telephone.
Tesla waited until the new year, and then hit the colonel with a direct assault. My dear Astor, Tesla said, it has always been my firm belief that you take a genuine, friendly interest in myself personally, as well as in my labors. Now I ask you frankly, when I have a friend like J.J.A., a prince among wealthy men, a patriot, ready to risk his life for his country, a man who means every word he says, who puts such a value on my labors, and who offers repeatedly to back me up, have I not a foundation for believing that he would stand by me when, after several years of hard work, I have finally brought to commercial perfection some important inventions which even at the most conservative estimate must be valued at several $1,000,000? Informing Astor that George Westinghouse had given him $500,000 for the AC polyphase system, and that Edward Dean Adams had invested $100,000 to become a partner in his latest endeavors when he had 14 new U.S. and as many foreign patents, Tesla remarked that there was a powerful clique which still now opposed him. And it is chiefly for this reason that I want a few friends like yourself to give me at this moment their valuable financial and moral support. Having placed faith in Astor's words, Tesla reveals that he had sold off securities to buy back control of his company, although Mr. Adams still has a minority interest. Having stated that his laboratory in the past has paid $1,500 for every $100 invested on the average, the inventor proclaims, I am fully confident that the property which I have now in my hands will pay much better than this. I now produce a light superior by far to that of the incandescent lamp, with one-third of the expenditure of energy, and as my lamps will last forever, the cost of maintenance will be minute. The cost of copper, which in the old system is a most important item, is in mine reduced to a mere trifle, for I can run on a wire sufficient for one incandescent lamp more than 1,000 of my own lamps, giving fully 5,000 times as much light. Let me ask you, Colonel, how much is this alone worth when you consider that there are hundreds of millions of dollars invested today in electric light in the various chief countries in which I have patented my inventions in this field? Sooner or later, Tesla continues, my system will be purchased either by the Whitney Syndicate, GE, or Westinghouse, for otherwise they will be driven out of the market. The inventor closed. Then consider my oscillators, and my system of transmitting power without wires, my method of directing the movement of bodies at a distance by wireless telegraphy, the manufacture of fertilizers and nitric acid from the air, the production of ozone, and many other important lines of manufacture, as, for instance, cheap refrigeration and cheap manufacture of liquid air, etc. And you will see that, putting a fair estimate on all, I cannot offer to sell any considerable amount of my property for less than $1,000 a share. I am perfectly sure that I will be able to command that price as soon as some of my inventions are on the market. Telling Astor that he had contracts pending with the Creusot Works in France, the Helios Company in Germany, Ganz & Company in Austria, and other firms, Tesla requested an investment of $100,000. If you do not take that much interest you will put me at a great disadvantage.
Should Astor come in, other Astor associates such as Mr. McKay and Darius Ogden Mills would do the same. If, Tesla wrote, after 6 months you should have any reason to be dissatisfied, it will be my first duty to satisfy you.
Astor stressed interest in seeing Tesla exploit his fluorescent lights, and the inventor agreed. On January 10, 1899, papers were signed whereby Astor gave Tesla $100,000 for 500 shares of the Tesla Electric Company. In return, Astor was elected director of the board. At the same time, Tesla moved into the Waldorf Astoria. Tesla also received $10,000 from the dry goods manufacturer Simpson and Crawford, and he may also have received funds from Mr. Mills or Mr. McKay. The old Tesla Company, with William Rankin and Edward D. Adams, was, for all intents and purposes, dissolved, along with his relationship with Alfred Brown and Charles Peck, although all of these individuals may have, in one way or another, been involved in the new enterprise. The first letter on Waldorf stationery written to the Johnsons is dated November 3, 1898. It is one of the rare letters in which Tesla refers to Mrs. Johnson as "My dear Kate." Tesla was about to hook a big fish, perhaps the wealthiest fish on the planet, and his sense of self-importance escalated accordingly. In haughty fanfare, the Serbian aristocrat separated his exalted ilk from other social tribalites, plebeians, drummers, grocery men, and Jews. Anti-Semitic references are rare in the Tesla correspondence, but no doubt he was anti-Semitic, at least in the social sense, that is, as a common reflection of the times. Anti-Semitism against ethnic ghetto dwellers, such as those newly arrived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and New York's Lower East Side, was common among the upper classes, even though the Rothschilds, Auguste Belmont, Jacob Schiff, and Bernard Baruch were well respected and known to be Jewish. It is, however, clear evidence of one of Tesla's prejudices. The letter also refers to Tesla's wish to meet Lieutenant Hobson, whose Cuban exploits have been featured in the Century. "The interest in Hobson was at a fever heat at our offices," Johnson recalled, "and the estimates of the sale of his proposed book ran into the hundred thousands." Unfortunately, shortly after his account appeared, a scandalous event occurred which was egged on by the sensational press, and the idea for the book fell flat. The incident had to do with Hobson's handsome appearance and the inability of women to refrain from kissing him when he came into their midst. "I would have cut off my right arm rather than to offend one of those ladies," Hobson declared, concluding, "The kissing episodes, what little there was to them, were entirely beyond my control, and my conscience is clear." The clashing lieutenant was well liked by Tesla and the Johnsons, and his entree into their circle added a wonderful spark to their lives. He would join a group that included at this time the Gilders, Miss Kushner, Miss Merrington, Mrs. Winslow, Mrs. Robinson, Mrs. Dodge, Rudyard Kipling, and John Muir. Playful jealousies became evident as Tesla and the Johnsons vied for the war hero's attention, Tesla daring even to tender to Hobson one lady with whom the inventor may have had intimate relations. "Remember, Luca," Tesla teased, "Hobson does not belong to the Johnsons exclusively. I shall avenge myself on Madame Filipov by introducing him to Madame Kushner, and somebody will be forgotten." Tesla spent many delightful hours with Hobson, inviting him to the laboratory, to dinner, and out on the town. "He is a fine fellow," the inventor concluded. Their friendship would last. Hobson, 28, a southerner, was a striking presence in his uniform, with deep-set, penetrating eyes, hair swept back, a firm, prominent chin, and a handlebar moustache. A graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy in 1889, he had spent 3 years in Paris, studying at a maritime college, and had worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence. Gifted with a keen mind, Hobson had worked for the Secretary of the Navy during the China-Japan War. His family, on both sides, included lawyers, judges, a governor, and a general. He was a ready-made hero, and he was a social catch of the first order. All the pieces of Tesla's puzzle were now in place. He had obtained fundamental patents on wireless communication and remote control. He had calculated the type of energy he needed in order to disturb the electrical conditions of the planet. He had obtained a sizable sum of working capital